This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
7:46 right now. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. Now, coming up on The Breakfast Grill, we're going to be looking at some major themes that have emerged in 2016. In fact, we're going to be doing that throughout this week, a look back at 2016. Today's focus is fintech. So 2016 really saw Malaysia explore new frontiers in fintech, new innovative ways to disrupt traditional finance business models. In fact, I believe earlier this year, Bank Negara set up that regulatory sandbox for fintech, kind of enabling experimentation of fintech solutions in a safe, regulated environment.
Yep. And also SE set up that equity crowdfunding platform as well. One of the first in ASEAN, actually a feather in the cap of the Securities Commission. And all this will serve to play into this whole idea of financial disruption.
Mm. So throughout this year, we've spoken to several fintech companies on The Breakfast Grill. Ibrahim Sani will be presenting us with a recap of the year that was with some of our best breakfast Grill interviews on fintech. So stay tuned for that. That's coming up in 20 minutes. But speaking about fintech, Jules, StarBiz reports that Tengku Dato' Sri Zafrul Aziz, the CEO of CIMB Group, well, he says that CIMB is cautious about the potential disruption brought on by fintech startups. You know, he says that fintech startups are nimble, they're free of legacy technology, and they are unregulated. Well, at least not as regulated as banks.
Yeah, I think they are a little bit afraid of this. And I think Bank Negara is also slightly cautious about the rise of fintech. But, you know, these financial institutions, I think all of them have got huge financial war chests. And I'm just asking the question of how come they are not trying to beat the fintechs at their own game, right? Because they themselves can invest into fintechs, can start fintechs, can create platforms on their own. And I think one of the biggest reasons is that the new products, Some of them could be conflicting with existing banking products or existing financial products. For example, recently we had the CEO of AIA, that big insurance company, on the grill recently, Anusha Tavaraja. And I asked her why, how they would approach fintech. And this is something that I guess financial institutions are reluctant to go into because fintech has the effect of shaking the existing earnings structure. So much of the structure is already tied to how you, for example, remunerate your staff, mm-hmm. the agency incentivization model. Whereas when fintech comes out, it's cost disruption from the word go.
Right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you're looking at lower transaction costs and you know the implications of that. But you know the point that you brought up, Jules, about why don't banks either invest in fintechs or kind of buy up fintechs or you know create new fintechs within part of their ecosystem. I'm just wondering whether fintechs can be considered part of the ecosystem, you know, that or could banks just buy them up and suppress them?
Yeah,
I find they have the firepower for that, right?
So I find that kind of thinking is going to be so revolutionary. For example, again, apart from insurance, where right today you can buy your own insurance directly online if you know all the principles of buying them. And that will rock the agency incentivization model. The other one is robo-advisors, right? If you went to a robo to buy directly, if a financial institution actually migrated from the old ways of agency selling to a robo, they will hit at the rice bowl of the agent. So I think the old financial institutions are very invested into their own incentivization models, into their old very lucrative products to want to shock that system and go into new products as what fintech offers.
Julian, is it possible that people will still want the brick-and-mortar banks, they will still want the human interaction, all those things that banks and the old model can still give them and promote as something of value, right? Because not everybody wants to be serviced by a robot, as it were.
Yeah, well, if you think about everything comes down to price, right? If you're paying 171% of a cost to the agents to buy an insurance policy, or if you're paying 5% to the agent for buying unit trust and another 1.5% to 2% management fee a year to be invested in a unit trust, Would you want a discount on that is the question that's going to be asked by fintech. And can fintech actually draw the business of people who don't want to pay that kind of fees?
Right.
And I think that they have been very successful in other parts of the world, like the United States. And today in the United States, we see robo managing billions and billions of dollars in terms of AUM. And also in terms of the ETF products that are out there, the ETFs have hit about $8 to $10 trillion of market capitalization in the United States. So this is something that's going to be unstoppable if people are going to look at low cost.
Yeah, so it really does look like banks are in for a challenging time ahead. I mean, you've got the threat of fintech, now also kind of global economic uncertainty that banks need to operate in. It's a new normal for banks now. 7.51 right now, moving on to ringgit inflation. Speaking about what we can expect next year, Malaysians can expect a weaker ringgit and higher food prices in 2017. Consumer spending will be reduced as imported goods become more expensive, pushing up inflation. In fact, Nomura Research says that it expects Malaysia's inflation to rise by 2.8% in 2017 from a 10-month average increase of 2.1% in 2016.
So if you look at the currency movements over the last 2 years from January 2015 to as of December 2016, and these are numbers that I guess are calculated by the Edge Financial Daily, the ringgit has lost over 21% in terms of its value. That compares with below 10% for a lot of the other emerging market currency. You look at China, they fell 10%. The Filipino peso fell about 10%. And the
right at the bottom of the list, Jules.
The worst performing currency in the emerging market world and possibly in the developed markets world as well. And this is something that's going to drive inflation because it's going to push up the cost of all the goods that we buy from overseas. And that's why inflation forecast has been pushed up by a full percentage points by the analysts around town, 2.8% forecasted for 2017 compared to, you know, just 1.something% this year.
What about the question of why? I mean, is that something that still vexes us? Are we concluded that conversation about why the ringgit fell? Is it, you know, oil prices? Is it, you know, non-deliverable forwards? Is it a government that is not trusted? I mean, have we exhausted that conversation? Do we just move on from now, from this point
on? I think, I mean, the we know of the reasons, right? But often they're out of our control. So stronger US dollar, can we do anything about that? No. Can we do anything about the US Federal Reserve rate hike? No. But they all impact the currencies. But what really bugs me is that it impacts all currencies, yet Malaysia's at the bottom of the list. So clearly there are additional factors that are impacting the ringgit.
Yeah, very telling. I mean, you call that risk premium, right? So if Malaysia were to follow the other nations, national currencies around the region, Malaysia should be only falling by 8 to 10% over the last 2 years, but we have fallen 21%. So I guess, Sharad, your question is very relevant. What explains that extra fall in the currency?
So I guess next year we have to brace for this. Chuti Malaysia lah, Sharad. What can we do?
Or no chuti at
no
all.
Chuti
I
at
mean,
all.
You know, it's actually quite, if you look at the front page of Sina Harian this morning, they have a focus piece on what's going to cost parents to send each child to school, right, with the start of the new school. It used to be between 100 and 200 ringgit to get their kids ready for school. It's now 300 to 400 ringgit a child for any parent. So you imagine working class parents dealing with their families at the start of the school year.
Yeah, and I think that off note is also the fact that the official CPI target of whatever it is, 1 or 2 or 3%, is very different from your personal inflation rate. I mean, if you're very focused on supporting education for your children, for example, that might have a much higher inflation rate than what official numbers suggest.
The Federal Land Development Authority, or FELDA, they have come out to defend their acquisition of a 37% stake in Indonesia's Eagle High Plantations, and they're buying the stake for $505 million. That works out to be about 2.26 billion ringgit. And of course, this comes amid concern that FELDA has overpaid for a stake that is non-controlling.
Yeah, well, I'm not so worried about the non-controlling factor. The fact is that this acquisition, very controversial acquisition, has been transferred from FGV, the listed company, to Felder, mm-hmm. which owns about one third of the listed FGV. So my question is whether this would be injected into FGV at some point, and at what price will it be injected into FGV?
So the concern, when FGV was initially looking at buying this stake, there was a lot of concern about the deal and the controversy and the pricing. And of course, FGV being listed, they had to be, you know, transparent and speak to all the investors and the shareholders. So do you share concerns because now it's not listed and everything becomes suddenly more opaque?
All I am worried about is whether the government will have to bail out such a transaction. But it just looks as though, reading the explanation that was given to the Financial Daily, this is sort of in the fashion of an FAQ, right? A frequently asked question. And they were asked about the valuation of Eagle High. And basically, Felder's defense is that they bought it at a discount, because if you crunch the numbers, the price that they bought it at, $15,500 enterprise value per hectare, that was even cheaper than what KLK wanted to pay for MP Evans. So they say this is much cheaper. And the other thing that it adds to the age diversification of Felder's crop. So that's advantages to them, they say.
Jules, you're using the enterprise value, but if you look at the share price, it's a 170% premium to what the current share price of Eagle High is. So again, if you look at the share price, you think, wow, they're really overpaying for this. But if you use enterprise value, then you think, oh, I got a good deal.
So like a very sleek lawyer, they have also addressed this question.
Okay.
they're saying that the share prices don't reflect the true value of Eagle High, because it's very illiquid in the Indonesian market. And from a conceptual viewpoint, this actually also makes sense, because if you, for example, look at stock markets, and if Eagle High was just traded to an extent of only a few lots in a market, here is Felder trying to buy a big 37% block of the market.
Right.
If you went into the market and bought shares, you would certainly push up prices substantially.
Well, also on kind of a political dimension, this over the weekend, PKR Vice President Rafizi Ramli says he plans to capitalize on Felder's planned purchase, to bring down the BN government because of what he sees as a kind of transaction, right?
Right.
He just sees this as problematic. But my question is, because
Nazir Razak weighed in with his very popular Instagram following as well.
Right. So the question is, are Malaysian voters moved by financial scandals?
That's a good question. I mean, it's a question we've been asking for a year and a half now.
Will, in fact, you know, a kind of, in some people's eyes, framing a dubious transaction, be read that way by voters? I mean, can you actually bring down a government this way? Rafizi Ramli remains hopeful.
Okay, all right, there you go for Rafizi Ramli. Tough times ahead, so we have to brace ourselves. However, AirAsia says that they're optimistic even in the face of slow economic growth, rising jet fuel prices and overcapacity and reduced passenger yields. In fact, I believe the head honcho of AirAsia, Tan Sri Tony Fernandez, believes there's an opportunity in every crisis, and he continues to be bullish.
The AirAsia group have it good both ways, right? If the ringgit is weakening, then he expects a lot of inward tourism. But if the ringgit is strong, then a lot of Malaysians would also go out and travel. I guess Malaysians are kind of trading down as well. Instead of going to your traditional, what seems to be perceived to be more expensive places, you can go to some of these other places that AirAsia is opening up, some of the more unexplored frontiers for traveling.
We're just saying chitty-chitty Malaysia, because of the weak ring.
Yeah, because remember that story a couple of months ago about where AirAsia really makes the bulk of its money? It's not apparently with passengers and all those kind of things that you kind of listed, Melissa, but in leasing planes. And they've actually sold off that part of their business, haven't they?
Yeah, they're going to get a lot of money from that business. I think it's not really finalized yet, and we don't know the full numbers, but certainly it's being valued at about $1 billion. So the purchase price would have to cover for the income loss from those from that unit. Also, ancillary income is a big part of their earnings as well. But last year, they actually made a lot of money from a 22% reduction in fuel costs. So that's driving a lot of their income
as well.
Okay,
that's a good thing. Ancillary income is really a huge revenue generator for them. I mean, every time you fly Air Asia, then you add on, I'm going to bring luggage and I'm going to buy nasi lemak.
You're a big fan of the nasi lemak.
I am a huge fan. I always buy the nasi lemak. Sometimes two, even.
Two nasi lemak.
Well, if you're on holiday, I guess you should indulge yourself.
Yes, but you know, they got me with the tickets are so cheap. I'm going to buy this and buy that, and I got a deal.
If you had to choose between Air Asia and Singapore Airlines running as a budget airline, what would you choose?
Convenience and timing, I think. I have, you know, yeah, depends on the cost.
Actually, one or two things that Tony Fernandez said that were very interesting. One is he couldn't help taking a jibe at the Malaysian airline, saying that the carrier has got some kind of an identity crisis, referring to the fact that Malaysia Airlines is now kind of a hybrid airline focusing on the low-cost sector as well as a full-cost service airline. The other thing he said was also that AirAsia is desirous of creating an ASEAN stock. You know, I'm not sure what that means. I don't think the article also highlights the full details of it, but it seems like he possibly would want to have AirAsia listed many parts of ASEAN.
Just on that note, Jules, Tan Sri Tony Fernandez has said before that he wants to create a truly kind of ASEAN airline, a truly ASEAN company. Again, you've seen that almost in every country now in ASEAN, Air Asia has some form of operations and they want to solidify that, you know, ASEAN open skies. Okay, we've got the Breakfast Grill coming up in about 20 minutes or so on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.